Good morning, science. My name is Alexandra McGald. As you'll notice, this is the shorter version of a longer interview that I did with Professor Uri Alon from the Weizmann Institute in Israel. His research work is absolutely brilliant, but here he was kind enough to summarize for us the very basics of personal motivation, particularly in a scientific environment. I can also recommend his article on leadership of a scientific lab and his really brilliant TED Talk. Have a listen.
What is motivating is these three essential vitamins. One is a belief in competence. So if you believe that you have some control over what you're doing, it doesn't mean that you have control, it's your belief. So you might actually be competent but not believe it, then you can't have motivation. And as a mentor, for example, the first project I gave to my first PhD student was way too difficult. It was like, take this 96-well plate fluorimeter and rewire it to measure temperature and bacterial growth as a function of frequency and stuff. That seemed doable to me as coming from a postdoc, but for him, it was impossible because he never even grew bacterial colonies, which is the basic thing. And in 2 weeks, his motivation plummeted. So I kind of backtracked and said, okay, why don't you make some bacterial colonies on a Petri dish? And then he said, good, you did it. Now let's measure their growth rate. Great, you did it. And what's the error? Let's do it again. So he could give positive feedback and kind of build a scale of increasing complexity so the person has feeling of competence. It should be somewhere between easy and impossible. That's where maximal flow and feeling of I was born to do this lies. And that's a moving window. So you have to listen all the time with your students where they are according to this skill. So that's competence. That's vitamin number one. Vitamin number two is called autonomy, which means my project flows for me. I own the project. I'm an origin. I'm not a pawn. Now, as a mentor, sometimes it's kind of a paradox. You need to sometimes you determine, especially in the beginning, a lot of what the project is. So how can a person own it? So I discovered a lot of times that in this co-creation of a project, they talk with students, and then the next week I come back and they just forgot everything I said, and I say it again. And then 1 week they come back and they say, look, I have this great idea. I look to this and I say, it's the project I discussed. I said, great, what a great idea. And then they own it. Of course, they do the same to me, right? My great ideas sometimes come from them. But the thing is that considering giving people choices inside the project and also listening to who the person is, and so the choice of the project is closer to their values and what they believe in, allowing people to time to determine, to explain their own project, and also maybe to have a side project which is totally their own and where they can go. All these are ideas on how to create autonomy, and there's also ways to ruin autonomy, like micromanagement. You care so much that the project is going to do that you overmanage, and that ruins autonomy. So I'm saying that, I've made all these mistakes. And so a mentor can ruin these vitamins or provide them. So we said competence, the belief that you have some control. Autonomy, the project stems from me. And the third one is human beings are social creatures. So this is called social relatedness. We need to feel part of a community, and we need to have somebody we care about our project. So it's impossible to do science in isolation. We do a lot of science on our own, but you can't do it in isolation. And that means that one of your tasks is to find the person that on a daily basis you can talk, listen, and that cares. It could be the mentor, it could be someone else. Without it, you can't have intrinsic motivation. And also, if you remember the feeling where you go to a meeting and you present a poster and suddenly feel that, oh, somebody else cares about my project. I'm not alone in the universe. It's extremely motivating. So sending students to even a local meeting, you know, to present could be transformative. My group meetings, for example, I designed for social relatedness. In the first half hour, we kind of waste it. We don't do science, but we do something very precious. We talk about whatever's going on, what movies we've seen, hobbies, volunteering, whatever, and we laugh a lot. There's a lot of laughing, eating. And then when we do the science part, you get questions and comments in a way that's very constructive, with a lot of softness, a lot of listening, and willingness to bring each other forth, you can say. So that investment in social relatedness, trips, et cetera, letting people teach something that they know how to do, even if they're new in the group, is the key to getting a group that is more fun to be in. And also, since in a group, as STEM people, we know if we have N people in the group, there's about n squared pairs, n minus 1 over 2. So if you have 10 people, you have, 45 pairs. And if some of them contribute 10% each one to the research, you have 4.5 times more research if you can get those pair interactions to contribute. I hope I was clear. So that's why if we take into account the, the subjective and emotional aspects of human beings in science, we can end up improving our bottom line, our objective, rational, quantitative bottom line. And also it's a value thing. What kind of group would I like to be in? And for me, it's extremely satisfying when I see two students helping each other. And then I do something which is just like parenting. I just praise that slightly, specifically, and people get that that's a value in our group. So even people with sharp elbows, they behave slightly differently because of the vibe of the group that I take care to perform. And that makes life in a group, in a research group, just worth living.